over the years if it ever had really been strong. So that when the old legislature came to town, most of the major legislation was prepared by the governor or by the cabinet officers, and they pretty much farmed it out to their friends or the people who sponsored it and then handled it. And the legislature had little or no capability of its own to really do anything. They had one or two staff people and a clerk and a sergeant, and that was about it. You depended heavily, not only on the lobbyists, but very heavily upon the executive branch of government, which lobbied a great deal. And legislative leadership did not too often challenge the executive. Governor Collins had his problems with the legislature, primarily over a racial matter. But the rest of the plural executive supplied most of the legislation. Well, in 1966, trying to get my year straight, Florida did, I think, finally legislatively do a pretty adequate job of reapportioning itself. The new members were elected, and in the same election, Governor Kirk was elected. And that was, if you'll recall the situation, we had an incumbent governor, Hayden Burns, who was a Democrat, who served a two-year term. And then he was defeated in the Democratic primaries by Robert King High, the mayor of Miami. And he was really the first breakthrough of a man who came from a South Florida, one of the left-out areas. Governor Burns came from Jacksonville, a relatively large urban county, but it, by virtue of geography and tradition, had always been in the pork chop gang Northwest Florida group, and it had been accommodated pretty well within that group, and it had never really related with the guys from Central and South Florida. Well, when Mayor High, who was the mayor of Miami, beat Governor Burns in the primary, it represented a shift of the political balance, really somewhat from North to South Florida. But the people with Governor Burns were so unprepared to accept this that they then did not support Mayor High, and they vigorously supported the Republican candidate, who I think, absent that factor, would never have been elected. But he was elected, although we did elect strong Democratic majorities in both houses. But Governor Kirk came to state government without ever having held a public office before and without really any knowledge at all of state government. And in his inaugural address, he surprised everybody by calling us into special session a couple of days later. And we had finally finished that up and gotten home when the district court then promulgated a new apportionment plan. And we had all new elections. And the court plan, I think, probably did apportion us a little bit better, but there were probably only really about four or five seats that where guys could not have run for re-election under the court plan compared to our own. It did not represent that big a change. And it was a real surprise, I think, to those of us from the urban areas as well as the rural areas. We had new elections, and Congressman Gurney, who's now our United States Senator, did a lot of TV work in the Lower East Coast. And the court order elections were special elections. The only people on the ballot were legislators. They were very low turnout elections. And you had a new Republican governor who was at the zenith of his popularity, which declined constantly thereafter. With the help from one of the most vigorous Republican congressmen who was trying to prepare his campaign for the U.S. Senate. And we just had a very bad time in that election. We had a substantial increase in the number of Republicans elected. In fact, all of our incumbent Democratic members of the House from Miami north to Volusia County, the Daytona Beach area, in through Orange, were basically wiped out. And so we came back then just as the term was getting underway with a Republican governor and with suddenly significant Republican minorities in both the House and the Senate capable of upholding a gubernatorial veto. And I think this had a dramatic effect on the legislature, and probably did as well, operated with these other things to cause the legislature to really start asserting itself as a co-equal branch of government. And the governor was, if we'd had a Democratic governor, I don't think we would have, really have cut ourselves clear of the apron strings as quickly or as easily. We would have been inclined to try to agree and still lean on the governor for a lot of help and leadership. But the positions became so antagonistic that we decided that the legislature had to be prepared to really sort of govern Florida whether the governor liked it or not. And so we undertook to write the general appropriations bill and to start acquiring staff for our committees and to put our own house in order. And I think that the combination of reapportionment, reflecting great change in the state, the combination of a Republican governor with competing with Democratic majorities in the House and Senate are two of the factors that help all this gel. And the governor himself, for instance, when it came to the subject of constitutional revision, he said privately to a number of us, he said, look, we want to revise the Constitution. Well, the preceding several Democratic governors had said the same thing. But then here's where he parted greatly with them. He said, frankly, I don't care a whole lot what you put in it. I just want a new Constitution. I'd like to be able to appoint the cabinet rather than have them elected, but I don't honestly see much chance of y'all agreeing to that. So y'all go ahead and revise the Constitution, and let's get a constitutional commission to working on it and get the job done right, and I won't bother you. And he didn't really. He had very little input into what was done there, so that a Democratic governor would have been full of ideas and direction and everything like that, and chances are very little would have been done. So that I think that all that helped a great deal, and I don't know of any Florida, of any other southern state that's had a, well, there have been several other southern states that have had Republican governors. I don't know if any of them have had Republican governors quite like the one we had, or that we could have had a similar experience with a different type of Republican governor. One who had not really too good an understanding of what state government was all about, who did not have the benefit of a very experienced staff, although he had some talented people working with him. And it gave us a challenge we may not otherwise have had to move out.
How do you feel about the tradition of rotating the speakership and the presidency of the Senate?
Well, I would say that in many ways it's been beneficial. And I realize that the overwhelming weight of authority, including intellectual thought, is that that it's bad. But I have felt that it continues to it keeps our system more open to new ideas and new enthusiasms, and I think causes more things to happen than if we were to settle down with more stable leadership and continuity of leadership. There are risks involved in it, and there are limitations involved in it. I can see now some real good reasons for having a permanent speaker that I didn't see before I became speaker. On the other hand, I think that our process will be probably more stimulated by the changing of the guard than if I or another person was to continue on as speaker. I've not really sat down to sort it all out, but I think that our rotation of leadership has been more of a plus than a minus.
How about the practice of selection of the speaker by the caucus before they next legislature comes in.
Well, I think that's a desirable thing to do. It gives the incoming leadership a little warning and a time to organize their program and thoughts and to set up. We have changed our caucus rules somewhat to do it in a slightly different way in the future, but...
Being challenged now, isn't it?
Not the system, the individual. Yeah, so that, of course, that can happen any time. I would say that Florida, like any state, could suffer if the membership makes a poor choice of leadership. And there are some who could provide more effective leadership than others. Now, the speaker in Florida is a little bit different animal than he is in some states. I'm sure you've seen many different variations on this. In some ways, I enjoy probably a lot more strength or stability or power than the speaker in, say, a state like California, who ostensibly is a permanent speaker. But still, a motion with the greatest dignity in California is a motion to declare the chair vacant. Now, this may make the speaker, although he's a permanent speaker, it may make him quite responsive to his majority bloc. But I am elected for a constitutional 2-year term. I have the right to be reelected, but the tradition has been otherwise, not any formal rule or provision. And I can pretty well decide what committees we're going to have, who the leaders of the committees will be, who will serve on what committee, what staff we'll have, and a number of other things. It would appear all by itself to be a tremendous grant of almost dictatorial power. And some speakers can determine also what bills are going to what committee, though there's some restraints on that. But after everything is said and done, you still have to have a majority of the members who are in general agreement with what you're doing, so that although they're not all written or spelled out, there are very practical limitations on the authority or the power of any speaker. If he still has to get people to do things because they want to do them, not because they have to do them, if he's going to be consistently successful in getting something done. And because of that, I don't think that, Bill,
yes,
are they ready?
It's about 10th on the agenda. And,
so that I would say that a bad speaker will probably not be as big a calamity as some would fear. And that a great speaker may not be quite as great a speaker as some of his closest friends or zealots would think, because of the fact that you've got many other people whose opinions and points of view have to be taken into account, and sometimes they don't do exactly what you want them to do. In the case of a good speaker, that may be bad. In the case of a bad speaker, it may be good. One thing I would be reasonably sure of, I think that when Speaker Pettigrew made some move towards having the more permanent leadership, that they put the cart before the horse in a way. I would say that if they want to have a permanent speaker or a permanent Senate president, that you will have one provided you make the job one that someone would be willing to hold and perform on a permanent basis. But it is, in our system, just about a full-time job with part-time compensation and everything else. And most speakers that I've known have been delighted to pass the gavel on, really, to the next speaker. They have needed to get back to their business or their profession. And I think the thing that would do more to provide for a permanent speaker than anything else would to take the salary and double it. Then if you had a fellow who really liked being speaker and a membership that wanted to continue him, he would be in a circumstance to continue. And Florida has not done nearly as much as a number of our sister states, Georgia, Massachusetts, and many others. There a speaker or Senate president can afford to continue.
How do you assess the cabinet system?
Well, it's one of our political dilemmas. If you were designing, if I were designing a system of government, I would not have the elected cabinet. However, it's one that's been fairly deeply engrafted into our tradition. Now, and to make it help you understand why it's a little hard to change that tradition. During many of the pork chop years, before our legislature was reapportioned, the cabinet were the good guys. The cabinet were the ones who ran statewide and who tended to be deferential to the urban areas, much more so than the legislature. So that the urban areas began to sort of forget about the legislature and let the bright young lawyers run for those jobs. The power structure really related with the governor and the cabinet, and felt that they had some input there because the guys had to stand statewide election. So that it's probably not been until 1968 or so that you begin to, with the emergence of a different kind of legislature, that you begin to sort of to confuse that image. And so that some of the cabinet officers now are beginning to look like outposts of the industry that they're to deal with. They're a little bit more of the bad guys. I think that the cabinet system could work very nicely for Florida if the voters ever selected a governor and cabinet officers who had reasonably similar points of view or philosophies. The odds of that occurring with any consistency, I think, are remote. Question I've had is whether or not the cabinet system is just too deeply ingrained in our tradition and constitution and everything else to successfully make any change in it, so that most of us have felt that that the effort to change it would be so extreme and the chance of success so remote that it would not be productive to do it, but to not hit the cabinet system head on and to try to make it work as constructively as possible for the state.
We've heard it defended on grounds that it brings executive decision making into the open.
I don't see that. If anything, very well obscure it. I think the executive decision making is most visible when one executive makes and is accountable for the decision.
But as a practical matter, the authority of the legislature has increased in the last 8 years only, hasn't it?
I would say so, yes.
In the appropriations process and otherwise. Mm-hmm. And as has the governor. Since the new Constitution.
Well, right. The new Constitution did not hit the cabinet system head on. It continued it, but it did do a great deal to strengthen the governor's position in the scheme of things. And
so you may be accomplishing that obliquely even if you didn't want to.
Right. To some extent, yes. And I would suspect that there may be a tendency on the part of some who have strong disagreements with some cabinet officers to question the system, yeah, rather than the officer. But they may not question other cabinet officers. For instance, I'd like to hear a discussion on this subject between, let's say, Dick Pettigrew, who has, I think, been generally opposed to the cabinet system and reasonably well thought out in his approach to it. And Bob Chevin, who is the Attorney General and serving on the cabinet. I think that Dick would generally strongly approve of Bob Chevin as a cabinet officer. And he may not approve of the Comptroller or the Commissioner of Agriculture or some others, but I would say some people who are opposed to the cabinet system may be much less opposed to it if they were different cabinet officers. And I think that as time goes on, the cabinet, like the legislature, will be more rather than less inclined to reflect the dominant view of the majority of the state. And I think that the cabinet, although it was ahead of the legislature in reflecting the public will, at this point as a whole lags a little bit behind it and has not made that adjustment. When it does, the cabinet may get along a little bit better with the governor and the legislature, and it may work a little bit more smoothly than it is at the moment.
Now, you're retiring as Speaker and also from the House. Does that
Yes.
mean you're going to drop out of statewide or state politics?
There is some speculation that I may be a lieutenant governor candidate, but that's all it is. And
how do you feel about it?
I have avoided giving it a great deal of thought. If the governor came to me and said that he would like for me to do it, I would get in high gear and think about it, and it would be a little bit of a dilemma. I enjoy public service to some extent, but I have grown quite weary of moving my family up here every year and moving back to my district and trying to cope with the law practice under all of this. And the governor put it to me this way when he was running. He said he'd gotten to the point where he either had to get into full-time public service or get out of it. And I'm at that point. And either alternative is reasonably attractive. But the governor has many good choices to make, and I'm not sure that I would be the best one for him, and I'm not campaigning for it. And
how about the cabinet?
No.
There ought to be some vacancies there, shouldn't there?
Yes. I've encouraged Ralph Turlington to run for Commissioner of Education, and he was appointed to the vacancy that occurred there, and I'm not interested in being Commissioner of Agriculture or any of the others. I might conceivably be, just because of the secondary role that the cabinet has as the State Board of Education, or no, I'm not interested in running for cabinet office. I think that what I'll do will be to go back, practice law, and try to be a little bit more helpful to other candidates. I've always been a candidate myself, and perhaps a little bit more reserved about being involved in other campaigns, at least in the primary stage. And I think I can probably be a little bit more active and helpful to people there. And if I get many opportunities for service arise, so if I figure I get unhappy with the practice of law or feel too restricted in it and want to get involved in some grand debates, I can find an opportunity to do that. They come along with probably greater frequency than we like. So that's probably what my situation would be.
How do you assess the role of the Democratic Party in state politics?
It's been changing a little bit at home. Generally, the elected Democratic official has given the party as wide a berth as possible. The party's had parties had little influence. It's not always enjoyed too good a reputation, and the dilemma for the Democratic office holder is whether or not it's worth the effort to try to straighten it up or to ignore it and be identified with it as little as possible. I think that the attitude of most public officials now is that you cannot or should not ignore it, and that the party ought to be improved and strengthened to be to play a more active, useful role. And I think that that's the direction that we're inclined in, but I'm not sure that the party has really made it, or that it the party itself is too strong or influential.
Has the problem on the local level been controlled by party organization, by people who are more strong on ideology than anything else?
Well, frankly, people at the local level who have been involved in the party in the past have been there's been such apathy that it's been very, very difficult to even get people to serve as precinct men and precinct women on local county executive committees. generally what will happen every few years is somebody will make a run at electing the majority of the seats to select a chairman who then tries to keep them filled through appointment, filling vacancies and everything like that, and they've been more concerned with survival and petty things than they have with anything of real substance.
The impression I have is organizationally Republicans tend to be stronger than Democrats.
Yes, I would say that's quite true. At home, some of us decided it would probably be better to shape the party up, and so that my aide at the time was elected, we offered a slate, and we can obtain the control of the party and elected the chairman and such as that, and it's sort of an intermediate stage now. There at least enjoy some a slightly improved reputation, and they are generally working to help the Democratic candidates in the general election, and they're not blowing what money they have on just advertising themselves. But I think that at the state level, the party has shown much greater or more active involvement than at the local level, except in a few counties. I think that the party generally has fairly good leadership, and I think that the governor and our junior United States Senator are both quite supportive. Not enough time has gone by, and the party has not acquired the muscle or experience or the money or anything else to really call too much of a tune.
You see then a stronger role for the party in the future?
Yes, I think it will become stronger and more involved rather than less, but we have a long way to go there.
Any regrets about the last 11 years?
Oh, not really.
Anything you'd do differently?
No, most of the legislative programs I've been really interested in have worked out fairly well. I was a zealot for reapportionment, and we are reapportioned about as perfectly as can be done. My next major subject area was in the equalization of public school finance, and we've been preeminently successful in that. Oh, I've got a long laundry list of things that need to be done and some suggestions I would make to the next crowd, because I'm sure that there are many more important legislative battles to be won. In fact, I can now see a number of new subject areas that had not occurred to me before that would warrant a great deal of time and effort. But I don't have any particular regrets. I would still recommend legislative service to anyone who I thought was really interested in doing it and who had the confidence and to be helpful. But many of us have different personal circumstances. I've got young children in my family, and I just have not. Every year, the first time or two I came up here, I commuted. My wife didn't like it. I didn't particularly like it. It was a matter of chasing home on Friday afternoon and coming back up here Sunday night or Monday morning. And it was very difficult to keep my law practice going or my law partners happy. And my children are now at an age, they're 10, 12, and 8, and they're beginning to be involved in more things. And after the first time or two of commuting, I found it was much better just to move them up here with me. So every session I've generally leased an apartment and moved my family up here. And I've stayed up here during the session and I'm gone except for one or two trips back on Saturday and moved back at the end of the term. But my children are now involved in school activities and Boy Scouts and Little League, and if I had to take a Democratic vote, my family would no longer come up here, and my
sounds
just
familiar.
About okay. This last year, I had a gross income right of about $50,000, but that included the sale of assets, and if my income from my public service and from my law practice has been in the neighborhood of $30,000 to $35,000 a year. And I can't, I mean, you can live very comfortably on that.